This talk was given by Jeffrey Shugen Arnold Roshi at Zen Mountain Monastery. Shugen Roshi is the abbot of the monastery and the Zen Center of New York City. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you would like to make a donation or to find out more about our retreats and residency programs, visit us online at zmm.org. Thanks for listening.
This is from Master Dogen's Shobogenzo. 300 Koan Shobogenzo, number 76, No Mind is the Way, the main case. Master Dogui was once asked by a monastic, what is the way? And Dogui said, no mind is the way. The student said, I don't understand it. And Dogui said, it's good to understand not understanding. The monastic says, what is not understanding? And Dogui said, it's just that you are not anyone else. The commentary. The way is beyond understanding and not understanding. Understanding is grasping at words and phrases. Not understanding is blank consciousness. When Zen practitioners hear, it's good to understand not understanding, they make a nest here saying, just this is it. They've not yet realized the intimacy that old Dogui is pointing to. What is this intimacy? It's not mine. It's not no mind. It's not like something. The verse. The great way is not difficult. Just avoid picking and choosing. In one, there are many. In two, there's no duality. So the student asking, what is the way? This is a question that's been asked so many times and so many different ways of responding. Matsu said, when asked what is the way or what is Buddha, mind is the way. Another time he answered, no mind. No Buddha, no mind, no way. Zhao asked his teacher, Nanquan, what is the way? And Nanquan said, ordinary mind is the way. Dogui says, no mind is the way. Dogen said, the way is originally perfect and all-pervading. How could it be contingent on practice and realization? This way is self-sufficient. What need is there for special effort? The way. It's the path, it's practice, but it's also, and it's also something that is boundless, like space. It lacks nothing, it has no excess, it has no fixed form. It has no inherent characteristic, it appears in an infinite number of ways. So when we look at something and say, that's the way, the teacher says, it's not that. When the student points and says, it's not this, the teacher points to something and says, it's this. All of the many ways that the teachings speak of, as Dada Roshi says, it's beyond understanding and not understanding. Understanding is grasping at words. Not understanding is blank consciousness. All the many, many ways that the teachers are basically pointing at the dualities, which are essentially the places where we take up residence. The places really where we look for salvation. When we attach to something, we're attaching to something, and in a sense, we're not attaching to its opposite. And so while it can sound philosophical or abstract, it's really talking about the direct experience of human beings everywhere. So Dogui, who's Guishan, says, what is the way? No mind is the way. So if anything is the way, that's just another way of saying it's liberation. And if something is liberation, then it can't be contrived, it can't be produced, it can't be something that you did. And if it's not contrived, then it's not born, it doesn't die. It's another way of saying it's just not of your own doing. So when Guizhan says no mind is the way, this no mind is not of your doing. And so the immediate way of hearing Guizhan's statement is to think of not thinking. But this no mind is not thinking. Thinking thoughts are impermanent, but not thinking is also impermanent. That's not a fixed state. And being impermanent, it's dukkha. It comes and goes. It's not ultimately peaceful or satisfying. It's not ultimately liberating. We can't rely on it, in other words. But if that's true, then why do we practice letting go of thoughts? Why is there so much in the literature about, in the teachings about the entrapments of our thinking mind? Why do we practice mindfulness, concentration? It's not so much because the thoughts themselves are at issue. It's rather so that we can have insight into the self-nature of thoughts. But that when thoughts arise, they arise from, because they're not separate and distinct, they arise in dependence on other things. In order for a thought to arise, certain conditions have to be present. And for so much of, so delusion is basically being in a state in which the thoughts that arise are so frequently conditioned by greed, anger, and delusion. And so it's not so much that the thoughts themselves are the obstacle, but that they're an expression of our entanglement. When we realize the self-nature of thoughts, then we realize that they in and of themselves do not bind us, they don't obstruct us, they're not offensive, they don't have their own power. And yet when they arise, they tend to proliferate. And in that proliferation, we get fooled. That's the thing, we get fooled. We get seduced. We can be seduced by just experiencing them as though they have their own power. They arise and we react. We have an emotional reaction. We have a judgment. We feel one way or another about the thoughts. And so it's our experience is as though something is happening and we need to defend ourselves or we need to gather them in. And so that's our bondage right there. And so we could ask, why do we give them so much power? If they don't have power on their own, then why do we give them so much power? Well, in a sense, thoughts are powerful. Thoughts, ideas, beliefs, they are powerful. And so we might think that when we are caught, that the power is not serving us well. We could also think of it as just a misuse of their power. The power that thoughts have is being, in a sense, misapplied. But when we understand them, then we can use them well. I mean, in a sense, that's what the teachings are. It's what a sutra is. What's what an aspiration is. And that's why they're an important part of the path. And then in letting go of the thoughts, we're not trying to get to a point where you never have another thought. I mean, I hope everybody's clear on that. But rather that thoughts arise from mindfulness, from samadhi, from generosity, loving kindness, compassion, patience. That ultimately they arise from the realization that, as Dada Roshi says, in one there are many, and in two there is no duality. That as thoughts arise, that it doesn't divide our mind. It doesn't divide or create a sense of two. And so that's why right understanding, right thought, right effort, right mindfulness, right concentration, all of these work together to bring us to realization. And that understanding, the student says, I don't understand it. I don't understand no mind is the way. And Guishan said, it's good to understand not understanding. That to develop right understanding, the first Eightfold Path, is really important. To understand each of the Four Noble Truths. To basically recognize that life is dukkha. To practice freeing ourselves of all of our attachments. To realize enlightenment and to take up the path. Because the Buddha realized understanding, and we can see pretty easily that understanding, that our understanding, our present understanding, is present in everything, in every moment, in every thought, in every action, in every reaction, in every belief, in our success and failure. And so, in our decision making, and so if the understanding that all of that is based on is not so clear, or is decidedly unclear, then what follows is going to be compromise, to say the least. So Guishan says, no mind is the way. And the student says, I don't understand it. And so what kind of understanding is this? And so in both in koans and also just in normal study, the language is used in different ways. Words, I mean, Dharma words, ordinary language is used in different ways. And part of developing our understanding is gaining understanding about how these words are being used. And understanding is kind of an amazing thing, you know, in just an ordinary life. That when there's something happening and then in some moment we come to some understanding, that's a kind of magic in our mind. Right? Where something that wasn't clear, something that was confused, something that was in conflict, that was not understood, not seen, suddenly there's knowing. There's a sense of knowing. And if it's conceptual, intellectual, still, there's a power in that. Something shifts. It's a kind of insight that gives us a meaning or understanding of something. It helps us make connections and apply it. And so just ordinary understanding is very powerful. And the Buddha recognized that. That's why he said that attachment to ideas and intellectual accomplishments is very very binding. recognizing that there is something very satisfying about that. I mean, you could just imagine the Buddha. He had a pretty amazing mind, right? And so he must have, I never really thought about this, but he must have had a very strong mind early on. And so as he was learning and growing up and being taught things and being groomed as the heir apparent of his father to take over the leadership of his community, he must have, you know, been in the realm of gaining understanding and knowledge and must have experienced the satisfaction, the power of that, the sense of power. And we bring that in not only to right understanding, but then into aspiration, that becomes the ground of our aspiration. In a sense, in order to have right aspiration, we have to have right understanding. And so when we don't understand our thoughts, when we don't really understand their nature, then they not only continue to flow strong, but they continue to have that sense of their own power. They continue to bind us and to sort of seduce us into their meaning, into their understanding. When we do understand the nature of thoughts, then they become more relaxed, right? Because they're losing that sense of their own power, which is that binding power. It's kind of interesting when we're stuck, then the power tends to be confining and trap us. It becomes very taut, rigid, right? And so too does our mind and our body and our breathing and our letting go. All becomes pretty tight. But with understanding, one of the things that naturally happens and basically that understanding arises from is a relaxation of all of that. And that's why it's so important to sit in a way that is cultivating a state of awake, wakeful ease so that the mind and the body, the breath, energy is very bright and awake but easy, relaxed. Because then everything begins to much more naturally open up. And the thoughts themselves, as we gain more understanding, the thoughts themselves become space-making, right? They tend to open things up rather than confine, to free rather than to constrict. No mind is the way, Guishan said. And Dada Roshi's footnote says, pile of bones on level ground. So he's pointing to the aspect of no mind, in which there's no high or low, there's no spring and summer, there's only winter. Right? Bereft of life, of things, of warmth. But it's not thinking. And this is where we can misunderstand the what samadhi is and the function of samadhi. Samadhi, in one sense, is single-pointedness of mind. That's sort of the basic understanding, although that itself, that term itself, is understood in different ways. And it is a form of spiritual power. It's also impermanent. It comes and goes, right? Which is often the disappointment within and following session, when you have moments where your mind gathers in, becomes very stable, very settled, very calm, very concentrated. Things open up, become very easy, and then it goes. And the next moment or the next day, there's anxiety again, there's confinement, constriction. and then we get attached, right? And so we try and sort of claw our way back to that state, which means we have to reject where we are in this moment. That's dukkha. I mean, that's the basic definition of dukkha. And so in that sense, we can understand dukkha is not something that is. It's not that samadhi is dukkha, or that thinking is dukkha. It's that it's impermanence, the fact that it is impermanent, and then how we feel about that, how we react to that impermanence, is dukkha. And so samadhi, in that sense, being a form of spiritual power, being something that we're cultivating, in a sense, is not still not something to rely upon. When we don't rely upon it, then its true power is available to us. When we attach, the power is diminished, in a sense, to whatever we're attaching to. And our sort of built-in understanding, our conditioned understanding, is that if we hold fast, that we will hold on to that power or to whatever it is that we're seeking, whereas just the opposite is what occurs. And so practice, the shin, is a continuous meeting of impermanence and of releasing, of not grasping, regardless of what it is that appears before you, whether it's heaven, whether it's hell, whether it's incredible, whether it's terrible, whether it's the fruits of your practice or whether it's fruits of delusion. And it's hard to do that. It's hard to let go when you apply yourself and you're practicing very diligently and then you feel like things are shifting and changing and you're experiencing some of those fruits. It's hard not to want to freeze dry them, right? So you can nibble on them at any moment. But it just won't work. It doesn't happen. No one has ever succeeded. So the student says, I don't understand it. I don't understand no mind is the way. And Guishan said, it's good to understand, not understanding. What kind of understandings is he speaking of? We need to understand that he's speaking, he's using ideas and concepts and words and the meaning of those words to bring us beyond all of that. In a sense, that's all of the teachings are that. No matter how simple and straightforward and direct, no matter how complicated or obtuse they might seem, they're all about that. Bodhidharma said, when you understand, then reality depends upon you. When you don't understand, then you depend on reality. When reality depends on you, that which isn't real becomes real, is experienced now as real. When you depend on reality, that which is real appears false. When you depend on reality, everything appears false. When reality depends on you, everything is seen as it is, true. Thus, the sage doesn't use their mind to look for reality, or they don't use reality to look for their mind, or their mind to look for their mind, or reality to look for reality. Their mind doesn't give rise to reality. Reality doesn't give rise to the mind. And because both mind and reality are still, they're always in samadhi. But this doesn't mean in a state of not thinking, of not having thoughts. When we don't understand, we depend on reality. That's a different way of speaking of the First Noble Truths, Four Noble Truths. Reality depends upon all things. Nothing stands alone. So when we depend on reality, we're sort of misapplying a fundamental truth. Everything is dependent. Everything is dependent. Nothing exists on its own. But this depend upon reality is not based in that understanding. This is, in order for me to have what I want, I need this. In order for me to be happy, to feel satisfied, to feel complete or whole, that is dependent upon something, which is true, but not in the way that I'm thinking of it. The way that I'm thinking about it is based in sort of a fundamental existential insecurity, a sense of incompleteness, of lacking, wanting. And being so fundamental, and being based in insecurity, it gives rise to fear. And so our attachments are always fear-based. There's always some fear if we look closely. And so whether it's dependence on people or circumstances or feelings, things to give us what we want, whether it's being dependent upon thinking or not thinking. So how good this session is measured by how many moments you've had where you weren't thinking. That is a recipe for frustration. Or if we're dependent upon being comfortable or being happy or not being angry or not being uncomfortable or not dying, or not being frustrated or disappointed, that means we're on a fast track to being frustrated and disappointed. It's pretty much a certain thing. It's coming. Because that dependence is based on the illusion that we are not dependent. That dependence, I depend on this, is based on the illusion that I am independent of this, that I'm separate from that. Which then, it makes sense that I would need to find something outside of myself that is not me. Thus the grasping. When you understand, then reality depends on you. Everything now depends on you. The three worlds are mind, the Buddha said. There is no world outside of mind. There is no world outside of you. What is this you? And so when Guishan says it's good to understand not understanding, how do we understand not understanding? Well, first, we have to experience not understanding, which is not a state of confusion. Confusion is a conflict within some state of understanding. We understand something, it's not working. And so, in the non-grasping mind, you know, it's like when you're walking along a precipitous trail and you're looking for handholds. You have one and you reach for the next one and secure your grasp before you let go of the one before. And so what we're doing is letting go of the handhold and not seeking another. And it's very difficult to trust that, right? Because we're such a knowing creature, right? Because knowing is powerful. It is gives us a sense of control, and it does, it's integral to how navigating our world. But it leaves the world out of it. It makes us separate from this world. And so when we realize not knowing, no mind is the way, when we let go of all grasping, which is not thinking, then we realize in our dependence that now we can stand alone for the first time. We can breathe our own breath for the first time, study our mind unafraid, live our life in intimate contact without depending on reality. So now we can live in mutual dependence in our world without looking for our fundamental happiness from that mutual dependence. When Guishan was studying with his teacher, was Bai Zheng. So this is very early in the Zen tradition. Guishan had just had a realization. And Bai Zheng said to him, "What you have experienced is a temporary fork in the road. In the sutras, it says, if you want to understand the meaning of Buddha nature, then you should look in the realm of temporal causation. If you want to understand that, that is unconditioned, that is free of time and place, past, present, and future, then look in the realm of temporal causation. Look in the realm of place and time. When it expresses itself, it's like delusion suddenly turning into enlightenment, like remembering something that you've forgotten, and realizing that the self and other things do not come from someplace else. Thus, an ancient teacher said, enlightenment is but the same as non-enlightenment. Thinking is the same as not thinking in its nature. Happiness is the same as sadness in its nature. Because it appears differently. And it appears differently because it is dependent. To arise as happiness, to arise as sadness, it's dependent on that which helps it to appear as happiness, appear as sadness. But it arises with the same, with the same nature. In a sense, with the same power. And so how do we use that power? Enlightenment is the same as non-enlightenment, without mind and without dharmas. It is just this mind that does not hold to ideas of emptiness or delusion, mundane or sacred. It's the original mind dharma that is of itself perfect and complete. Having arrived at this, he's speaking to Guishan, you must uphold it and sustain it. And so the student says, what is not understanding? And Guishan says, it's just that you are not anyone else. It's like remembering something that you've forgotten, realizing that self and other does not come from somewhere else. It's just that you are not anyone else. When we forget the self, and that too is something that we can misunderstand. And when Dogen speaks of forgetting the self, or he spoke of his own experience of body and mind falling away, he's not speaking about samadhi there. In samadhi, there is a releasing, right? A non-binding or non-grasping at a sense of self, at a sense of body and mind. But when Dogen speaks of dropping body and mind, he's speaking about something else. When he speaks of forgetting the self, he's not just talking about being in a state of non-thinking. When the self is forgotten, realized, when all grasping is realized as empty, when the heart and mind are realized as empty, then when we realize that nothing has come from anywhere else, that you are not anyone else, then there is no more isolation or alienation or distance. You are not anyone else. You are not you. You are not not you. That's why Dhatarishi says, in one there are many. In two, there is no duality. And this is why when we get, you know, caught in this mind that judges and compares, that is attracted to and loves this and is repulsed by and hates this, is offended, is, you know, entranced, that can never lead to peace. It leads to moments of pleasure and pain and, you know, momentary experiences of things that pass by quickly, but it can never lead to any ultimate sense of peace. Because all of that is based in a sense of depending upon other things. And so when something arises that we love and we feel so attracted to it, it's because that sense of, I need this. I need this to fulfill what I'm seeking. And when something that is difficult arises and we reject it or suppress it or fight against it, it's because that is keeping me. That's going to prevent me from fulfilling what I want to fulfill. And it's that view that we call delusion. The thing itself is just the thing itself. And that's what we're trying to, that's how we're trying to meet that in practice. To be mindful of the body in and of itself, of the breath in and of itself, of a feeling in and of itself. It's just that you are not anyone else, and that it's just that things are not anything else. So we can only practice that which is sitting on your seat. That's your domain, right? And when we practice that, well, that includes everything. Because what you see, it's just like to focus your mind on the breath, right? Simple, just do it. Just do that, okay? And so when you sit down to just focus on your breath, you realize that, well, you have to deal with your body. What are you going to do with your body? Your hands, your back, your neck, your head, your eyes, your throat. How are you going to breathe? What are you going to do? What does it mean to just focus on your breath? What are you going to do when something other than your breath arises? And so just to do that, we realize we have to expand our study. We realize that that includes much, much more. We begin to see that there seems to be nothing that it doesn't include. And so practicing what is on your seat is including everything. But it's also why it's really important that we, you know, study and be gaining understanding about our particular constellation of body and mind, of karmic obstructions, of memories and thoughts, of beliefs, of neuroses, of predilections, of all the stuff that makes the stuff of you the stuff of you. And rather than thinking of all of that as being an obstruction, like when you just get rid of all of that, then everything will be free and clear. Think of all of that as the way by which you're working out your liberation. Because you can't do that in a void. Practice depends upon, you have to practice something. And in that practice, we arrive at the place of no unconditioned mind. And so if you sort of meet what you're experiencing as, you know, different beings that are providing you with the opportunity to understand understanding and understand not understanding, then maybe we'll treat all of that a little bit more kindly. When Baijing was practicing when Guishan was practicing with Baijing, he was sitting late one night, and Baijing came in to sit with him. There was a fire to keep them warm, and it had gone cold. And so he asked Guishan to stir it up, to bring forth the flame, and Baijing said, it's gone cold. The fire is out. So Baijing picked up a poker and dug deep and pulled out a red-hot coal and held it up to him and said, you said there's no fire left. And at that, Guishan had a realization. You said there was no fire. What is this? Sometimes we think the same thing about ourselves. The fire's gone out. There's not much coal there. What about this? To be human means there is a fire within. We each came with that. To bring that forth is to bring forth light and warmth. It's just that you are not anyone else. An old master said, ordinary sentient beings are Buddhas. They are temporarily deluded. We could hang a sign. Just temporarily deluded. Don't worry. Due to momentary defilements, once these are liberated, then there are only Buddhas. So practice your temporary delusion well.
Thanks for listening. You can find more Dharma talks, interviews, and events at zmm.org/media. While online, please check out the Jizo Project, our multifaceted initiative to make Zen Mountain Monastery more accessible and welcoming to all. Learn about the new Jizo House building and accessibility enhancements to existing facilities that are just two aspects to this exciting endeavor. Find out more and see how you can get involved at zmm.org/ Jizo Project. That's JIZOPROJECT.